Hello, this is Alton Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by the Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Angier. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored so that every funeral is as unique and special as a person it represents. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Well, we begin this week's Triangle Business Journal, as usual, with a look at the biz page. A quick look at Triangle happenings. And under the heading of online comes the article, Johnston County Walk Takes Its Ghost Walk Virtual. With Halloween approaching, but COVID-19 still in the air, an annual ghost walk will be going virtual this year, as if the prospect of another Zoom call wasn't frightening enough. According to the Johnston County Heritage Center, the annual ghost walk in downtown Smithfield will be available online this year instead of its typical physical performance. The actors and actresses will be performing in individual 3 to 5 minute videos that will premiere on the organization's YouTube channel, which is Johnston NC Heritage, beginning October 29th. The Ghost Walk, which has been hosted by the center for the last 15 years, generally sells out. Ghosts this year will include Old Man Lynch's ghost, who is said to haunt the site of an old bridge crossing over Mill Creek in Meadow, among other locally significant historic figures. And under the heading of Deal comes the article, City of Raleigh Names Finalists for Unique Project. Who says a dollar doesn't go very far anymore? An affordable housing project in downtown Raleigh took a major step forward on October the 6th, when the Raleigh City Council voted to approve 4 finalists for the Lane Idlewild Project. This site is made up of 3 parcels, totaling 1.17 acres, at 907 East Lane Street on a block that sits between Lane Street Mini Park and Oakwood Cemetery in the West Idlewild neighborhood. Altogether, the parcels are valued at $1.45 million. The city is offering the land for $1 to the developer, with the best plan for the land's highest and best use, affordable housing. The finalists are Archive Development. They propose building a total of 30 rental units across 10 lots, each with a duplex and an accessory dwelling unit. There's CASA. They propose 11 retail units across duplexes and quadruplexes, all available to residents at less than 40% AMI. There's Merge Capital. They propose 44 rental units across a collection of detached, attached, and ADUs. And finally, the fourth group is Raleigh Area Land Trust. They propose 16 cottage court units for sale across 8 duplexes. Under the heading of Helping Out, Advance Auto extends deal with Heart Association for another 3 years. Advance Auto Parts is one of the biggest public companies based in the Triangle, and the firm is upping its support for the American Heart Association. Advance Auto has announced a 3-year extension of its support for the AHA, which will include fundraising at its stores through October the 15th. Customers can donate $1, $5, or $10 to support the association's fight against heart disease and strokes. Many of our customers and team members have been impacted by heart disease and stroke, and it's one of the many reasons we are so passionate about supporting the American Heart Association's life-saving mission, says Tom Greco, CEO at Advance Auto. Advance Auto Parts began supporting the association in 2018 and raised more than $1 million last year. Association CEO Nancy Brown says her organization was incredibly grateful for the support. Under the heading of Perspective comes the article, Joint Venture Looks at Politics from View of Those with Disabilities. A new joint venture between LCI Tech and Walk West is aimed at equalizing the lives of people with disabilities. Dubbed ABLR, Abler, the new firm just announced its latest audit, which examined the official websites of the presidential and vice presidential nominees for November's elections. The firm found 44 violations in total across the four sites, potentially, according to the firm, shutting out voters living with a disability from critical information. The audit, which included people who are blind and visually impaired, showed that President Donald Trump's political campaign website had four website violations, while former Vice President and Democratic candidate Joe Biden's website had 13 violations. Under the heading of Foodie Alert, new Vivian Howard cookbook focuses on simplicity. Vivian Howard, the star chef who created the Chef and the Farmer restaurant in Kingston, has a new cookbook designed to make cooking simple and just as delightful. The book, This Will Make It Taste Good, is focused on easy-to-make recipes and includes a wide variety of options from tomato pies to her take on a simple way to make Eastern North Carolina barbecue. Boring, bland dinners of basic Brussels sprouts and boneless, skinless chicken breasts will be nothing more than limp, dry memories in your house, she promises. Her first book, Deep Run Roots, was widely acclaimed, but as Howard notes, that book doesn't represent the way I cook at home most days. The new book is intended to address that and help those with less skill and time achieve success in the kitchen. Book goes on sale October 20. And finally on the biz page, under the heading of Different Season, comes the article, Asheville Turns Over a New Leaf, Empty Fall Hotel Rooms. The colors are starting to peek out from the mountaintops in Asheville, a sure sign of fall. But whether the tourists will also arrive remains an open question. We've been seeing a trend line that is increasing in terms of occupancy, which is reassuring, says Marla Tambellini, Vice President of Marketing at the Asheville Convention and Visitors Bureau. It's not back where we want to see it at this point. Even though the numbers are improving year over year, we still are down in the neighborhood of 30%. Hotel occupancy in Buncombe County was at 42% in June, but rose to 56% by August. October is a key month for the market, the heart of the six-week stretch where the changing leaves are in full display. The six-week period contributes $250 million in visitor spending in Buncombe County, about 11% of the yearly total, Tambellini says. Normally this time of year, hotels are packed. But as Tambellini says, the weekends and leaf peeping season are still strong, but the midweeks are slow. For example, Asheville's Grove Park Inn has rooms available from Sunday, October the 25th to Thursday, October the 28th. Developing projections this year, given not only COVID, but the overlay of the elections and hurricane season and a number of other factors, is very difficult, she says. We remain hopeful that visitors will come in the community, but in a safe and responsible manner. Well, next we turn the page to the finance and technology pages of this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of technology comes the article, Chapel Hill Firm Targets Fund at Musk's SpaceX. A Chapel Hill investment fund has bought a multi-million dollar stake in Elon Musk's SpaceX. Morgan Creek Capital Management has closed on a nearly $13.5 million special purchase vehicle called Morgan Creek Private Opportunities, LLC Series F-SpaceX, aimed at acquiring a stake in the rocket maker. The round included 73 investors from 45 states, according to a securities filing. Mark Yesko, founder of Morgan Creek, says that unlike most of the firm's special purpose vehicles, where his team comes across the opportunity and sells it to investors, this one came from clients' requests. They wanted a stake in SpaceX, and Yesko and team found early backers willing to cash out. It's a very interesting company, he says. There are a lot of people who want to be involved. I think it's a high-profile name and a high-profile industry where a win could be very visible. The challenge for SpaceX and any emerging technology company is turning milestones into profits, Yesko says. They've had some great outcomes, but it's still early, he adds. Now, under the heading of transportation comes the article, RDU Parking Revenue Plummets as COVID-19 Slashes Airline Travel. The ongoing pandemic is costing Raleigh-Durham International Airport millions of dollars, and it's not over yet. Just through August, the pandemic may have cost RDU more than $27 million, and that's just in parking revenue, according to new data. When it comes to operating revenue, parking in front and center of Raleigh-Durham International Airport. In the 2019-2020 fiscal year that ended in March, for example, it was the biggest revenue generator on the list, accounting for almost $65.2 million of the nearly $173.6 million generated by the airport. But new records show that COVID-19 has decimated parking figures in recent months. Numbers show that when it comes to parking, Park RDU Central is traditionally the big moneymaker. In February, for example, it accounted for nearly $3.3 million of nearly $4.9 million in parking revenue for the month. Nearly 90,000 transactions were recorded in February alone. Fast forward to April, however, and it was just under $101,000 at Park RDU, with less than 3,600 transactions for the entire month. In April, the airport's worst month so far in terms of passenger counts during the pandemic, just 4,400 parking transactions closed across all of RDU's parking facilities. The airport made a total of about $149,000 in revenue from parking that month. A recovery has started. By August of this year, total monthly parking revenue was nearly $1.1 million. But the recovery is still slow, particularly as a look at historic numbers show that in 2019, the month of August meant $5.9 million in revenue. Through August 2019, RDU numbers show the airport had brought in $43.2 million in revenue from its parking operations. But for the same period in 2020, the revenue adds up to just $15.8 million. Now we continue with the finance and technology articles from this week's Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of They Said It comes the article, Volcker Rule Revisions Could Be Good for Local Startups. Revision to what's called the Volcker Rule once again allow banks to invest in venture capital funds, a, quote, great win for entrepreneurship, quote, according to a statement put out recently by the National Venture Capital Association. And local venture capitalists say it could mean more money for startups in the Triangle. Lister Delgado, managing partner of Durham's Idea Fund Partners, says, we expect that the recent changes to the Volcker Rule will create opportunities for smaller regional VC funds to pursue funding from banks, creating a significant positive effect on the funding environment in many communities that may lack broader sources of capital. And along with this article, there are quotes from Mitch Mumma, who is co-founder of Durham's InterSouth Partners. Mumma says, we will have to wait and see if a bank like PNC, headquartered elsewhere but with a large presence in the state, would make commitments to local funds. I don't think it will be a massive influx of dollars, but I'm happy they changed the law. Similarly, Tom Rue, CEO of Entrepreneurial Support Organization NCID, says, I doubt any of our active investment groups in the state would be opposed to additional sources of funding. Finally, on our page, technology page for this week, comes the article, Durham Startup Mindsumo, or Mindsumo, acquired by Virginia firm. Not even a pandemic could get in the way of crowdsourcing innovation startup Mindsumo's exit. The Durham startup is being acquired by Virginia-based enterprise software firm MBO Partners. Financial details were not disclosed, but co-founder Keaton Sweat says the team is excited at the opportunity ahead under the MBO umbrella. We're extremely excited to be joining MBO, especially with these crazy circumstances everyone finds themselves in, Sweat says. With the deal, four of MindSumo's six team members are joining MBA, and all will stay in Durham. Sweat's experiences as a student inspired the company. He wanted to build something for students to work on real projects, to use them as a mechanism for innovation. MindSumo's innovation platform allows companies to crowdsource ideas and insights by posting online challenges. Then a company of 500,000 users submit solutions in order to win money and recognition for their problem solving in areas such as market research, product development, and rollout plans. MindSumo will operate as a business within MBO and continue to serve its current client base. Brands that have used its platform include Microsoft, Coca-Cola, Disney, and Starbucks. The boards of both companies have already approved the deal. Next, we turn the page to this week's healthcare and higher ed pages in the Triangle Business Journal. And under the heading of Venture Capital comes the article, Carry VC Firm Cashes In on Its Biggest Exit Yet. A Carry Venture Capital firm, growing since 2014, has earned its record exit following the acquisition of one of its portfolio companies, a milestone the president says will help the firm continue to grow. Robert Ross, president and managing partner of Harbright Ventures, says the firm has exited a Florida-based life sciences fund as part of an acquisition. The move will bring the firm and its investors $15 million. Ross says the firm invested about $2.6 million into Florida-based Osiris Medical, which was working to develop a stent for the treatment of aortic dissections. The company was acquired last month by Atlanta-based CryoLife for about $200 million. Under the terms of the acquisition, CryoLife paid $80 million up front, consisting of $60 million in cash and $20 million of its own stock. There's also up to $120 million worth of future milestone payments. Ross says Harbright has been investing into Osiris over the past 2 years, and the deal will see up to $15 million returned to investors, most of whom are North Carolina residents. We've had a great return for our investors, but this particular investment is going to save a lot of lives, Ross says. We're really excited about that. And also on the healthcare page for this week is Morrisville firm lands major federal funding deal. A Morrisville company working on a therapeutic targeting E. coli has landed a contract with the federal government to develop its drug, including $77 million in funding the CEO says will carry the pipeline through development. Locus Biosciences has signed a contract with the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority to develop LBP-EC01. That's a treatment for E. coli bacteria causing recurrent urinary tract infections. Under the terms of the partnership deal, BARDA will provide up to $77 million in funding to Locus as part of a $144 million program to support Phase 2 and 3 clinical trials, as well as other activities required to seek marketing approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. According to Locus CEO Paul Garofalo, it's hard to understate how big the partnership is for the firm. It's a massive inflection for us, Garofalo says. The best way to put it is we now have a co-development partner in the U.S. government to take our candidate on the way all the way commercial. This provides a massive bridge for us now to get to become a revenue-generating biotech company. It's huge, he adds. And a couple of short articles on the page. On the move is an article, G1 Therapeutics Names New CEO. Research Triangle Park-based G1 Therapeutics announced the appointment of Jack Bailey Jr., as the new president and CEO beginning January 1st. According to the company, the decision comes as its current president and CEO, Dr. Mark Velica, has decided to step down from the position. He's been CEO since 2014 and led the company onto public markets in 2017. Bailey most recently served as the head of the U.S. and Puerto Rico therapeutics divisions at GlaxoSmithKline, a position he left at the end of 2019. Prior to his 11 years with GSK, Bailey served in various leadership capacities at Eli Lilly and Company. And under the heading of Key Deal, SAS and RTI announced new partnerships. Two of the Triangle's largest companies are joining forces to combine leading-edge research and analytic expertise in a new partnership. Cary-based SAS and Research Triangle-based RTI International announced a new partnership combining their expertise for service to governments and other organizations. According to RTI, the partnership will entail RTI and SAS combining subject matter expertise, scientific rigor, advanced analytics, and technical and software products into comprehensive solutions, building the ideas combining talented people with powerful software will generate more and better data insights to meet customers' greatest needs. Now we turn the page to the real estate articles. And the big article in this section is entitled First Raleigh Crossing Mixed-Use Tower Takes Shape in Downtown. A massive new mixed-use office tower is taking shape in downtown Raleigh as work is underway on the office portion of the 19-story building. In August, the Fallon Company celebrated a partial topping off after the topping out of the parking garage amid ongoing construction of the office floors for the first building in its Raleigh Crossing development. The project is situated on 1.86 acres at 301 Hillsborough Street at the intersection of the Warehouse District, Glenwood South, Capital District, and Fayetteville Street District. Altogether, the project calls for two towers totaling 280,381 square feet of Class A office space, over 18,000 square feet of street-level retail, and a 250 to 300-unit apartment community. The first phase is currently under construction and expected to deliver in quarter four of next year. "This is something we are now in the thick of," says Zach Van Cannon, Fallon's managing director for Raleigh and Durham. Fast-growing software firm Pendo has already signed on to lease the top five stories in Phase 1, with the rest currently available for interested tenants. Fallon broke ground on the first phase in September of 2019. In addition to Pendo's leasing the top floors of the building, Van Cannon says the building can also accommodate mid-building signage, which would still command a prominent view over much of the city. Meanwhile, plans for the second tower had initially called for hotel, residential, and retail space, but the company is considering changing those plans. The project is also easily accessible via several main roads into the city. Van Cannon says, "You're not getting into the congestion of downtown, despite being in the middle of it all." The tower is Fallon's first project in Raleigh and its first to break ground in North Carolina. And under the heading of Replacing WeWork comes the article, Longfellow Unveils Plan for Massive Life Sciences Hub at Durham ID. Following its purchase of the Durham ID buildings and the announced departure of WeWork, Boston developer Longfellow Real Estate Partners has unveiled plans to bring a massive new life sciences hub to the co-working floors. Longfellow announced October the 6th that it plans to bring over 100,000 square feet of state-of-the-art lab space to 300 Morris Street, in space that was once leased by WeWork. The co-working giant announced earlier this year that it plans to vacate the space by the end of 2020. The new space will add several floors of new lab space in downtown Durham, with plans to deliver the project by summer of 2021. Durham is one of the nation's fastest-growing hubs for life sciences innovation. We're executing a strategic plan for Durham ID that will serve top companies and research institutions in the region and bring more jobs to an already dynamic market, Longfellow partner Jessica Brock said. The labs we are building, ranging in size from 8,000 to 10,000 square feet and larger, will address a critical need within downtown Durham for high-quality lab space and will complement the incubation spaces that are currently available. The company is currently building out the space on spec as demand for lab space around the Triangle continues to grow. And continuing with the real estate pages of this week's TBJ comes the article, Boston Investor Grabs Apartments Near UNC Rex. A Boston real estate investor with a growing presence in the Triangle has purchased a Raleigh apartment community. Boston-based Eaton Vance Real Estate Investment Group recently paid $55.25 million for the Lee House Apartments, which features 245 units across two four-story buildings. This community is situated on 6 acres at 2411 Still Forest Place off Lake Boone Trail and near UNC Rex Hospital. The property features a mix of 1 and 2 bedroom units and amenities including a pool, a fitness center, coffee bar, and more. Rental rates range from $1,075 per month for a 1 bedroom unit to as much as $1,725 per month for a 2 bedroom unit, according to apartments.com. The seller, a joint venture between Carter Heston and KKR, bought the property last year for $51.97 million as a part of a two-property portfolio purchase. Howard Jenkins and Kevin Kemp with CBRE Southeast Multifamily represented the seller. Jenkins and Kemp also represented the joint venture of DRP and the Carlyle Group in the closing of Crabtree Lakeside earlier this week. Next, we turn to this week's cover story for the Triangle Business Journal, and it's entitled The Promise of Selling the Dream. There's a little note here that says about this project. The project name is based on a historical reference relating to Union Army leader William Sherman's promise of getting 40 acres to slaves after the Civil War. That promise, which came to be known as 40 acres and a mule, never came through as President Andrew Johnson rescinded the order after taking office. In hindsight, January 2020 was perhaps an ill-fated time to launch business, certainly not the best of times to have leased office space for a new company. But for Camila and Matthew Wordsworth, who opened their eponymous real estate firm the day after the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, it's been an amazingly good year. The couple, who have worked as a real estate team since 2016 and were formerly affiliated with Raleigh Cary Realty, says COVID-19 had an unexpected impact on sales and residential real estate. It helped motivate potential buyers from just window shopping the idea of home ownership to take the plunge. People who were on the fence for years finally said, "I'm done. I have to buy a house." Especially with prices going up in new construction, how many people are seriously looking for a house, Camila says. The shift was evident almost as soon as the stay-at-home order began. As Matthew explains, the people who were looking in March, April, and May were extremely serious because no one was going out. It was almost guaranteed if we took someone out to look at a home, they were going to buy. In the first 3 quarters, their firm processed 88 transactions, including 70 deals that closed before October. Another 16 are scheduled for the first quarter of 2021, already putting $5 million on the books for next year, and quarter four shows no signs of slowing. According to research from Metro Study and Myers Research, sales of new homes produced 3,472 verified closings in the second quarter, which represents the highest number of Triangle area closings in a single quarter since 2007, and the growth spurt continues. New home closings in the third quarter are far outpacing home sales in the second quarter, says Amanda Hoyle, regional director of Metro Steady. Sales of both new and existing homes in the months of April and May came to a near standstill with the onset of the pandemic and corresponding economic recession. But by June, July, and August, sales of new homes in particular have hit new highs not seen in this market since 2007. The business model at Wordsworth Group is particularly focused on first-time home buyers. We built our business on educating clients, Camila explains. The firm hosts a home buyer seminar twice a month that anyone interested in purchasing a home is eligible to attend. We turned our in-person seminars into webinars, and our numbers have increased dramatically. Before COVID, we had 20 or 30 attendees for the in-person events. Now we're seeing around 40 attendees per month. It's been a nice jump, she adds. We always had an issue with the conversion of people from the home buying seminars to speaking with lenders, but we haven't had that issue lately. Now more people are ready to talk with lenders. They've seen financing become more difficult during the pandemic, but because their education process stresses that buyers should bring credit scores up to at least 640, their clients come to lenders prepared. A lot of our clients are working to build their credit, and we have people who are furloughed or are still seeking employment, but they're working on their finances, so as soon as they have full-time employment, we're able to get them pre-approved, she says. Although they work with clients across all demographics, the demographic served most often has been Black women between the ages of 35 to 55. Most of their clients are first-time home buyers, and Camila adds, Black families statistically don't have as much in savings. It's difficult for people who don't have a lot of savings to move into many of the neighborhoods in the Triangle. Data released by Wake County on September 28th indicated that 47% of home sales in the first quarter of 2020 were below $300,000. For the month of August, only 38% of the home sales were under $300,000. What is affordable today is way higher than it was a year ago because everyone is moving up. At least within Raleigh, there's maybe one neighborhood in the low 200s in new construction, Matthew says. The way they see it, the barriers to affordable housing are less about race and more about income levels. If statistically a group of people fall into that lower income category, it affects their buying power. And we're seeing that with homes that theoretically should be more affordable, he says. They also see anecdotal trends when it comes to financing deals that are difficult to quantify, but impossible to ignore. It's nothing that can be proved, but you just wonder, if either I or my clients were white, would this situation be different? You probably will never know, but it's a feeling you get. Doesn't feel like you'd be going through the same situation or have to jump through the same hoops if it were the other way around, Matthew says. Camila believes that implicit bias exists and creates a very real barrier. We have situations where a Black lender will have a transaction sitting on an underwriter's desk for weeks. One deal during COVID sat on an underwriter's desk for a month, and it's only supposed to take 1 week, maybe 2 weeks, she says. It's not even about Black and white. It's if you're friends with the underwriter, she says. Another area that concerns them is when investors purchase homes in neighborhoods intended to provide affordable housing. The investment properties become rental homes, which impacts the value of homes throughout the neighborhood. This ends up happening in neighborhoods with a large Black and brown population, Camila says, adding that neighborhoods in outlying communities such as Apex and Holly Springs typically have a limit on rental properties. But in Southeast Raleigh, neighborhoods could have 45 or 50% rental properties. There's a lot of shady stuff that happens in real estate in Black and brown communities. Well, as usual, following the cover story in Triangle Business Journal, there's an executive voice column. This week's column This week's executive voice belongs to Reed and Jacqueline Smith. They are founders of a company called River Wild, launched in September of 2014. They have several affiliate firms, 127 Homes, Providence Construction, and Jacqueline Smith Properties. And they have over 200 employees. And here's the article. As Johnson County continues its explosive growth, Reed and Jacqueline Smith have spent the last 6 years in the middle of it all with their one-stop shop development and brokerage firm, River Wild. The husband and wife team launched their company in 2014 and had three affiliates, including a construction firm, that's Providence Construction, home builder, 127 Homes, and real estate agency, Jacqueline Smith Properties. The Smiths met in college at Campbell University and married in 2007, shortly before graduation. She worked for years as a teacher before the pair launched River Wild. We both played collegiate ball together at Campbell, and we were friends before we dated, Jacqueline Smith says. When the opportunity to present itself to do a building company and real estate company, we took advantage, and it seemed right. The company started with just one other person. Today, the company has more than 200 employees. It's been a whirlwind, Reed Smith says. We've definitely not been able to do this without a lot of great people. We've learned a lot with them. Today, River Wild has several major projects planned or underway in Johnston County, including Ashcroft Section 2 in Clayton. That project calls for 293 single-family units, 299 townhome units, 180 apartment units, and 105,000 square feet of commercial space. The company has also started construction on Academy Point, which is set to include 133 single-family homes, 110 apartments, and 12 townhomes. And while the development construction wing of the business is booming, Jacqueline Smith Properties continues expanding as well. Last year, the company was the 10th largest residential real estate team in the Triangle, according to data compiled by Triangle Business Journal this year. Each year, we've gotten better, learned more about our systems, and our processes have gotten stronger, Jacqueline Smith says. Our group as a team has rallied together and gotten stronger. It's an encouraging environment and family-friendly environment. And while Johnson County continues to grow, Reed Smith says it's important to keep them for them to keep qualities that make the county so attractive. Clearly, the population has changed, but the cultures and the values and the people are still the same, and we fight hard to keep that culture alive and that small-town feel, he says. Even though it's a little more populated, it's still the same county I grew up in. Growth for the sake of growth isn't the goal. Both also credit much of their success to their team members and to Johnston County. The best thing Johnston County has going for it are its people. Just good, kind-hearted, down-to-earth people, Reed Smith says. It's a vibrant economy with the industrial sites here in town, the short commute to Raleigh, the small-town feel, and the culture of the people. Even amid COVID-19, the Smiths say they've been able to adapt to the new normal, ensuring staffers stay as safe as possible and are properly equipped while still connecting with clients and selling homes during the ongoing housing boom. It's definitely been a learning experience. For us, our people are first, and their safety is the most important, he says. We've learned and adapted. We instituted procedures to keep people safe. It's definitely been a balance of keeping production growing. Home sales have continued to soar as mortgage interest rates remain at historic lows. And as homes in the Triangle continue to get more expensive, Jacqueline Smith says the company has carved out a niche providing and marketing more affordable homes alongside their other products. We try to stay in a world where we provide affordable housing to buyers. I think people are looking for more space and land, she says. As the business continues to grow, Smith says they've enjoyed working and running the business together and getting to know each other's talents better. It's a dream come true to work with Jacqueline. It's fun to do life with your best friend, Reed Smith says. Our different talents play off each other. Where I may be more focused on the nuts and bolts, she balances that with the customer experience. She says, it's fun. Clearly, God created us with different gifts and talents. I've enjoyed getting to see Reed's business mindset and functionality. We hear a lot. I could never work with my spouse. I don't know how you guys do it. But we've done it a long time, and we enjoy it, and it's something we want to do for a while. Next, we turn to a news article that shows up in this week's Triangle Business Journal, and it's entitled, Massive Overhaul for Cary Town Center Has Start Date. After years of planning and preparation, the developers leading the transformation of the Cary Town Center have announced plans to break ground early next year. On October the 1st, developers Turnbridge Equities and Denali Properties revealed the name for the upcoming mixed-use urban hub with 4 million square feet of space, Carolina Yards. It's going to be a total transformation, says Jason Davis, managing director for New York City-based Turnbridge Equities. In its place, we'll have an urban street grid, much like you find in downtown Raleigh and downtown Durham. Plans for the Carolina Yards call for 1.2 million square feet for office use, $360,000 square feet for commercial retail, 450 hotel rooms, 1,800 multifamily and townhouse units, and over 10 acres of open space. The project is situated on 87 acres at 1105 Walnut Street in Southeast Cary. Leveraging our deep history in retail, we're focused on transforming struggling retail properties into highly engaging mixed-use environments to enhance and better serve communities, says Adam Williams, founder and CEO of Denali Properties. Carolina Yards is emblematic of that vision, reflecting a quality mix of commercial, residential, hospitality, and civic offerings within an urban, walkable setting lined with vibrant streets and open spaces. The developers plan to demolish nearly all the existing mall space following the holiday season. The existing Dave & Buster's and bulk buildings will remain. Davis says the mall is currently about 60% occupied. After the demolition, the plan is to start on the first phase in February in the hopes of completing construction on that phase in late 2022 or early 2023. That first phase will feature each of the uses planned for the development. Davis says the name Carolina Yards addresses the triangle as a whole and emphasizes the development's outdoor amenity spaces and walkability. We tried to find something that spoke broadly to the region and the triangle, and it really does operate as a whole, Davis says. People that live in Cary are just likely to go to a restaurant in Cary as they are in Raleigh, Durham, or North Hills. And as the project has evolved, the company has made changes to accommodate the post-COVID world, including extensive outdoor spaces and outside terraces in office buildings. We have a unique opportunity to be one of the first projects in the triangle to be truly post-COVID design, Davis says. We'll have curbside pickup and drop-off. We'll have around 100 surface parking spaces outside storefronts, a lot of outdoor dining. People really enjoy outdoor dining. Planning and design firms are the project are Gensler Sassailt, Little Diversified Architectural Consulting, McAdams, and Horde Kaplan Macht. Within each firm, the companies work to maximize variety in the buildings planned for the project. Each building was designed by a separate architect. It creates this feeling that it's something that evolved over time rather than a project that got delivered all together, Davis says. CBRE was brought on as a pre-development consultant early in the project. The company is now handling marketing and the tenant search with retail consulting and leasing by CBRE's Corey Nix, Kerry Dunleavy, and Charlie Coyne, and office leasing by the CBRE Raleigh Investor Leasing team. Coyne says they expect a wide range of local and national tenants, from smaller shops and boutique fitness to chef-driven restaurants and more. Our design is very authentic, and the focus is on being really approachable for professionals, millennials, college students, really everybody, he says. We have a sort of marquee brewery taproom space. There's over 10 acres of outdoor space and green space. The project will feature several office buildings with creative office space designed to accommodate everything from a growing startup to a major corporate headquarters. The location is right off I-40, and you're really in a central location in the Triangle, said Brad Korsmeyer, Executive Vice President for CBRE, Raleigh's Advisory and Transaction Services Group. This offers an opportunity for a uniquely designed office in a dense, mixed-use environment. The company has held a Zoom call with local entrepreneurs September the 30th to show what the project will have to offer. Developers have yet to reveal any tenants, but say they hope to make announcements in the near future. We're strong believers that tenants and guests are looking for authentic experiences, says Andrew Joblin, founder and managing partner of Turnbridge Equities. As we did at our Music Lane project in Austin, Texas, we'll seek to bring together a best-in-class mix of retailers, hospitality concepts, and office tenants at Carolina Yards. And in this short article from around the state comes the article J.P. Morgan Chase joins redevelopment in West Charlotte. A major bank will open a branch on Beatty Ford Road in Charlotte early next year as part of a real estate project at what's been identified as a pivotal intersection for the West Side. J.P. Morgan Chase will occupy about 3,200 square feet for a branch at 2023 Beatty Ford Road, a 7,676 square foot building that eFix Development Corporation will upfit for new commercial uses. In April, eFix Development, led by Christopher Dennis, acquired three parcels at the southwest intersection of Beatty Ford Road and LaSalle Street. The 2023 Beatty Ford Road site, which totals just shy of an acre, was purchased for $1.25 million, according to Mecklenburg County Real Estate Records. Dennis's professional background has mostly been in affordable housing through eFix Housing Solutions, which he started in 2011. He also founded a nonprofit, Community Dream Builders, that in 2013. The Beatty Ford Road development represents a foray into commercial real estate for eFix, although Dennis has done several residential projects in the area. It's the first of what's expected to be several commercial developments by eFix in the card. Finally, we turn to the last page of Triangle Business Journal, which is the viewpoint page. There's always a guest article in here, and this week's is written by Alan Berube. Berube is with Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program in Washington, D.C. His article is entitled How COVID-19 Changes Swing State Politics. There are two vital maps for understanding America in 2020. First is the throng of electoral college maps forecasting the presidential election outcome this November. Second are maps of COVID-19 hotspots in the U.S. as the disease carves a devastating path through different communities. Brookings Metro Recovery Index tracks the economic trajectory of nearly 200 metropolitan areas around the country, including 33 located in the battleground states of Florida, North Carolina, and Ohio. Parenthetically, he adds, these are among the most closely contested states. Analyzing these trajectories reveals differing economic contexts both across and within these swing states, as well as a potential influence on voters' decisions for the next occupants of the White House and Capitol Hill. Overall, job losses between February and August 2020 were somewhat steeper in North Carolina at 7.6% and Ohio 8.1% than in Florida at 6%. While COVID-19 hit Florida harder than the other two swing states, especially in the summer months, its state officials have been less restrictive than those in North Carolina and Ohio with regard to closing businesses and schools, which many argue accounted for the summer spike in Florida cases. Not all of Florida's metro areas escaped steep job losses. Its two most impacted metro areas, Miami and Orlando, are major sites for domestic and international tourism, an industry hobbled by the pandemic. and Miami, those industrial impacts compounded declines in economic activity stemming from high COVID-19 infection levels over the past few months. From an electoral standpoint, economically harder hit Southeast and Central Florida are two of the state's Democratic-leaning regions. Ohio exhibits a similar diversity of job loss patterns. On one end of the continuum are Northeast Ohio metro areas Cleveland and Youngstown, where August job totals remained 11% below February totals, reflecting particularly steep declines in education and healthcare employment. By contrast, job losses in Cincinnati, Dayton, and southern Ohio were considerably less severe. As in Florida, this pattern points to potentially less severe economic impacts from the pandemic in Ohio's Republican-leaning regions. In North Carolina, by contrast, economic pain seems widely shared across the state's major metro areas. The COVID-19 recession has hit jobs in high-tech and professional service centers, for example, Charlotte, Durham, and Raleigh, manufacturing hubs, for example, Greensboro and Hickory, and tourism destinations, for example, Asheville and Wilmington, in nearly equal measure. Small businesses in Ohio's major metro areas are reopening more quickly than those in major Florida and North Carolina metro areas. In August 2020, the number of small businesses open in Cincinnati, Cleveland, and Columbus was between 8% and 13% lower than January baseline levels. Cincinnati was the second strongest performer on this indicator among the 50 largest metro areas. Although Miami, Orlando, and Tampa experienced roughly comparable overall job losses, the number of their small businesses open in August were 28%, 20%, and 20% lower, respectively, than January baselines. Miami ranked last among the 50 largest metro areas on this indicator. Small business closings also impacted Charlotte, down 19%, and Raleigh, down 23%, more severely than major Ohio metro areas. It's not clear how much the local impacts of COVID-19 and the recession will color voters' views in the November election, including in the swing states studied here. But at the very least, those impacts could influence the salience of health and economy-related issues for people who are deciding whether to vote and which candidates to choose. If voters in these three swing states interpret local health and economic conditions as a referendum on the current White House and Senate documents, that would suggest more support for Democratic challengers in highly impact very large metro areas, or more support for Republican components in less impacted smaller regions. Of course, such patterns would align with pre-pandemic voter sentiments in these and other states. Thus, instead of reshaping the electoral map, the local dimensions of the pandemic and its economic fallout could further entrench deepening partisan divides between America's biggest urban areas and its smaller cities and towns. Now for this week's editor's notebook, which is entitled COVID Relief Bill Should Be Split for Business and Workers. Sometimes you have to look back to determine your path going forward. Our Washington lawmakers need to do the same when it comes to providing economic relief for workers and businesses hurting from the ongoing pandemic. On March 27, when the $2.2 trillion CARES Act was signed into law, the federal government agreed to send $1,200 to single filers making under $75,000 per year and $2,400 for joint filers earning less than $125,000 per year. The law also allowed for an additional $500 for dependents under 16 years and $600 in additional unemployment benefits for people who lost their jobs. That portion of the law was designed to send money directly to individuals and their households. For businesses, the government set aside $659 billion in forgivable loans for companies, sole proprietors, independent contractors, nonprofits, and other groups, as long as they spent most of that money in paying their workers and paying their utility bills. Fast forward to now. Essentially, all that money, almost $2.2 trillion in total, is gone. It was sucked up by the system we call the economy. So where did that money go? Mostly in the hands of large corporations. Need proof? Check the stock market. Congress is planning a similar bill to help Americans and U.S. companies. Lawmakers from both sides are essentially fighting over the size of the relief package. Democrats want a similar $2.2 trillion package, and Republicans want a skinnier $1 trillion package. But what they really need to do this time is have two bills, because if we don't, we'll be in the same situation in a couple of months, especially if COVID-19 forces a new set of closures in the coming weeks. The first bill should be to help individuals and families who will receive money directly from the Internal Revenue Service under identical guidelines in the CARES provision. Also in the bill should be the reinstatement of $600 a week in additional unemployment benefits. That's it. That's all the bill should contain. In the second bill, lawmakers need to address the plight of small businesses. They could cap the help for companies with 250 workers or less, which would cover more than 90% of businesses. In that bill, Congress could reinstate the Paycheck Protection Program, also known as PPP. Using the unused $130 billion from the previous PPP initiative, and perhaps add another $170 billion to it. But this time around, companies have to show at least a 25% decline in revenue streams to be eligible for the money. Beyond making businesses use the money to keep the workers, the bill should also extend the eviction moratorium for another 12 months for businesses struggling to pay their rent. That would allow landlords of residential and commercial properties to qualify for PPP because they can show loss of revenue in their application. Also, businesses not applying for a PPP loan should receive extended tax credits for retaining their employees and receive additional incentives when they help workers with their mortgages or utilities. By splitting the bill, Congress will send money directly into our economy because those IRS checks will be used for clothes, grocery, shoes, and a few discretionary items. Also, firms in need will get some relief. As we now know, the original PPP helped a lot of businesses, but the money in the end was parked in the hands of corporations. That model has to change this time. Well, that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, that's ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. Call us at 919-832-5138.